Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The housing market is still in trouble. So is the global economy. Also, apparently, men. Who knew? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 22nd of June. So good to have you with us. However they do it, the analysts who try to guess how many homes are going to sell in this economy each month, well, they kind of blew it. A report on existing home sales for May fell way short of the mark when it came out this morning, down instead of sharply up. Also higher in the longer-term trend is the number of Americans who are delinquent on their mortgages or actually in foreclosure. One of the government's big ideas to fix that hasn't really worked out so well. The Treasury Department's latest report says the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP in the vernacular, has only helped 340,000 people get their loan payments reduced. And more than a third of the borrowers enrolled in that program have dropped out. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Christine Schoenwald bought a home in Glendale, California, 8 years ago. She started having trouble making mortgage payments after her salary got cut. So last summer, she turned to HAMP. Her loan still hasn't been modified.
We submitted the paperwork 2-3 times, and they lost it. They would tell me things like, you were pre-qualified, then no, you weren't qualified. I spoke to dozens and dozens of people. I would get a different answer from every single person that I talked to.
It's a nightmare.
Housing economist Christopher Thornburg says the banks aren't equipped to handle this program. He says a colleague of his told him about a particularly frustrating short sale.
He said, I just couldn't get them on the same page or couldn't get them on the phone at the same time. I said, so who was the first lien holder? And they go, well, Bank of America. I said, but who was the second lien holder? And they're like, Bank of America. That gives you some sense of just how sort of screwed up everybody is.
Bank of America declined to go on the record, but told Marketplace it was committed to mortgage modification. But banks aren't the real problem, says financial analyst Greg McBride. He says the program is flawed.
There are a lot of people that are in homes that they could never afford, and even with a reduced payment, they're so far upside down that they don't have the desire to continue to make the payments.
So far, 440,000 people have dropped out of the program. That's 100,000 more than have gotten mortgage payments reduced. McBride says part of that high dropout rate is due to unemployment. People lose their jobs, and even a much lower payment is out of reach. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There are big economic doings up in Canada this week. The G20 summit's going to be in Toronto. The agenda will be pretty much the same as it's been for the past 2 or 3 years, how to steer the global economy out of financial crisis and recession. There is a small twist this time, though, some discontent between the U.S. and the Europeans. Europe and much of the rest of the world has debt on its mind, austerity and frugality. The Obama administration, on the other hand, says we need more government spending to sustain the global recovery. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Europe wants to tackle its debt. Nobody wants to become the next Greece. But President Obama is warning world leaders not to tighten their belts so much they choke off economic growth. The White House wants to avoid a Hoover moment, repeating President Herbert Hoover's mistake of cutting government spending too early. That prolonged the Great Depression.
This is absolutely the main topic in the G20.
Kenneth Rogoff is an economist at Harvard. He sides with the Europeans in this fiscal fight. He says they're proposing sensible austerity measures, while the U.S. risks another financial crisis in Europe by pursuing global economic growth.
We're talking about reducing growth slowly at a measured pace versus risk of a round two on the financial crisis.
Jacob Kierkegaard is an economist at the Peterson Institute. He says the global economy won't take a big hit from the European measures.
That's going to take European growth down to about 1.5% rather than perhaps 1.8, perhaps 2%. And that, quite frankly, is, again, not something that warrants a huge fight over this issue.
U.S. exports could be hurt by Europe's tighter budgets. Less stimulus spending means less demand. But how much do we sell to Europe anyway? Bob Eisenweiss is chief economist at Cumberland Advisors.
You know, the health of our economy is not critically dependent upon marginal changes in the level of exports to Europe. We have a lot of trading partners.
And many of those partners are expected to agree to disagree with the U.S. at this week's summit. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Austerity in the sharpest sense is the economic buzzword in the U.K. today. The new government over there unveiled its first budget this morning. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Today, Britain's new finance chief, George Osborne, began wielding the axe.
This budget is needed to deal with our country's debts. This budget is needed to give confidence to our economy. This is the unavoidable budget.
He's imposing a sharp increase in sales tax, deep cuts in welfare benefits and public services. The opposition Labour Party said this would stifle growth and throw people out of work. But financial markets were impressed. They liked the government's pledge to wipe out Britain's budget deficit within 5 years. David Buick is with BGC Brokers.
This was a really clever budget because it was well presented. It was austere, but it offered hope. And it was clearly well thought out.
One measure was generally popular. The government promised to levy a tax on all large banks operating here. This should raise around $3 billion a year. Banking analyst Michael Prest says Britain's largest European partners are following suit.
They put out a joint statement today saying that the British have announced their specific proposals first, but over the summer, France and Germany are almost certainly going to follow with some comparable measures.
Britain's finance chief said the crisis started in the banking sector, and so it's only right the banks contribute to deficit reduction and recovery. Britain, Germany and France are now urging the US to slap a similar levy on American banks. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street had some austerity of its own today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The state of New York is trying to close a multi-billion dollar hole in its budget. So as part of the emergency spending bill that the legislature passed yesterday, the cigarette tax in the Empire State is going to go up to $4.35 a pack. That means New Yorkers are going to be paying upwards of $9 a pack, almost 11 when you add in city taxes. Seems like an easy answer for lawmakers in terms of raising revenue while pushing smokers to quit. And so you'd think all the other states would be racing to follow New York's lead. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains, not so.
On the streets of Midtown Manhattan today, we wanted to see if $11 a pack will cause smokers to cut back. Here's 36-year-old Laura DeRay.
Ultimately, I'd like to say that it would make me smoke less, but it just doesn't. It just makes me go more broke.
And here's 46-year-old Gregory Baer.
I will have to cut down just because my wife will kill me if I don't. That's what it comes down to.
There's no question about the effectiveness of cigarette taxes for Peter Fisher. He's the vice president for state issues at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
For every 10% increase in the price of a pack of cigarettes, you would normally expect to see about a 7% decline in youth smoking and a 2% decline in adult smoking.
And Fisher says cigarette taxes do a fine job filling budget gaps, too. He says states have raised tobacco taxes more than 100 times in the past 10 years.
You know, some states like New York, like New Mexico, have increased their taxes multiple times in that period. So the vast majority of states have taken this action.
As for the ones that haven't gone as far as New York, Fisher says smokers are voters, too, and 20% of Americans smoke. Bert Wisenin studies state budgets at the National Conference of State Legislatures. He says for many states, a tobacco tax hike can't solve a budget crisis.
Tobacco taxes might be 4% or 5% of state revenue, so they're not a major source of revenue.
Of course, some states rely on the tobacco industry for jobs. North Carolina claims 255,000 of its jobs are tobacco-related. It has one of the lowest tobacco taxes in the nation at 45 cents a pack. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
was a point late last year and early this where women were a majority of the American workforce. Men are back at just over 50% in the latest survey, mostly because of seasonal changes and the kinds of work the economy provides. But in general, this recession has put far more men out of work than it has women. And changes in the labor force could be just a symptom of some larger gender-based disruptions in society and the economy. Hanna Rosin writes in The Atlantic magazine this month about the economic troubles that men are having in an article called The End of Men. Hanna, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Couldn't help but notice, and I get that you don't write the headlines for your articles, but there was no question mark on The End of Men. It's kind of done already, right?
That's true. Usually you can convince the editors to at least put a question mark to save you the barrage of emails that you'll get later vilifying your article. So it's true. There is no question mark. That's true.
It's basically we're living through the change right now. This recession has brought the changes and the future is us.
I would say that this recession has sort of accelerated and uncovered the changes that they've been happening for a long time in the economy and in relationships. But the recession kind of made us all see them in a way that maybe we wouldn't have sat up and taken notice earlier.
Is it as simple as saying that the new economy, the 21st century economy, is just better suited to the skills and talents that women have?
It might be that, because you couldn't argue, say, for example, that women have gotten smarter than men, you know, that we've bred a superior breed of woman. I mean, that certainly is not true. But it does seem to be that whatever skills are required, I mean, you can take college as the most obvious example. How can you explain to yourself why women do better in college or why women do better in school? It's not that men and women have radically changed or women are a lot smarter. It just seems to be that whatever skills are required these days, women seem to be better at them.
And it translates into the workforce, these management issues and all of that.
Yes, you look at job growth in the future economy, you take the top 15 jobs, and the great majority of them are jobs that tend to be dominated by women. I mean, the irony there is that they're nurturing types jobs. They're jobs that open up because upper-class women are going more and more into the workforce. And so then middle and working class and lower middle class women start to do the jobs that those women used to do for free, such as childcare and elder care and food preparation, for example.
You have this great series of quotes from these college-age women. You went out to Missouri, I guess, and you talked to these obviously bright, ambitious women who are dating these guys who clearly these women think are just schlubs.
I was really surprised by that. That kind of clinched it for me because when I was in college, certainly we all assumed that, you know, I would be working and I would have a job. My husband would work too. It was a kind of equality vision. And then I go to this working class college. It's a state school. It would not be anathema for people to have traditional ideas of marriage roles. And yet what I found was the exact opposite. And I was walking around the cafeteria. The people I ended up quoting were three sorority girls who were sitting together. And indeed, they have a very casual assumption that they are going to be taking care of all the business, that their husbands are sort of not going to get their act together and that they're going to be the ones who are making most of the money and their husbands will be home taking care of the kids.
Is it fair to say that men are being squeezed out of the economy?
They are doing less well than women, but I say they're being completely squeezed out. I think that's slightly unfair, but they are having a hard time retooling. I mean, if you look at the job statistics, all the jobs that are growing, say nurses, there's no natural reason why a man can't become a nurse, but for whatever reason, it's hard for them to adjust. If women over the last 100 years, they have had to change their notion of who they are and what they do many times, very radically over the last century. You know, can a woman with children work? Can a woman with young children work? What kinds of jobs can a woman do? There's lots of professions that started out as male-dominated and then became female-dominated, teachers and secretaries being the most obvious example. But there are almost no professions that have gone in the opposite direction where they started out as female-dominated and men have started to do them. And so I think our notion of what a man can and can't do in this country is it changes, but extremely slowly, whereas our notion of what a woman can and can't do and what's acceptable changes much more rapidly. Yeah.
Hanna Rosin, in the current issue of The Atlantic magazine, her article is called The End of Men. Hanna, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, all hope in one child.
Whether it's English lessons or piano lessons, parents are going to spend money and time in making sure their kids are equipped to rise.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial skidded 148 points today. That's nearly 1.5% at 10,293 at the bell. The NASDAQ came to rest 27 points lower, almost 1.2%, 2261. The S&P 500 carved off 17 points, more than 1.5%, closed at 1,095. Oil stocks were lower today. BP, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips shares all drilled down more than 2%. Stock in ExxonMobil sank nearly 2%. Oilfield services company Halliburton dropped almost 4% today. Crude oil prices, by the by, declined for the first time in 3 days to about $77 a barrel. Drop in home sales hit a variety of stocks. Alcoa reversed course from a 5% surge yesterday, gave back more than 3.5% today. Bonds rallied. The yield on the 10-year T-note pulled back to 3.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of May. The Federal Reserve wraps up one of its regularly scheduled meetings on interest rates and the economy. And June 23rd is United Nations Public Service Day to celebrate the value and virtue of service to the community. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
You know, we figured we'd start letters today with a little laugh. A couple of weeks ago, we heard from the Hot Mess sketch group from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. They came by the studios for the first and probably the last installment of Ask a Hedge Fund Manager.
I don't have a boat.
Get a boat.
I just got laid off.
You're killing me here. A boat is only like $2 or $3 million. He doesn't have a boat? What does he jump his motorcycle onto?
I keep coming back to listen to this. It's so funny. From now on, when someone comes to me with some kind of problem, my first question is going to be, well, how big is your boat?
Sarah Ford there from Worcester, Massachusetts, don't know what size her boat is or whether she has one. Moving on to something not amusing at all now, the Gulf oil leak. Back on day 58 of the spill, that'd be 6 days ago, we asked our man in London, Stephen Beard, what people over there are saying about President Obama's tough talk about the company formerly known as British Petroleum. Some have called it anti-British rhetoric. Michael Mullen wrote from Santa Clara, California, to put the shoe on the other foot.
Suppose that the BP oil leak had been in the English Channel. The coast of France from Calais to Normandy would be under oil. By comparison with what Mr. Sarkozy of France would say, I believe that President Obama's language is positively complimentary.
Penelope Livingston of Tampa, Florida, wrote about our story last week from Canada, where a business district in Toronto hooked an iPod to a PA system and played some really bad music in the hopes it would get people to shop.
This sounds like just the kind of horrible, obnoxious, loud invasion of my personal peace idea my city would latch on to.
We got a lot of letters wondering about licensing, whether the businesses could legally play that music for the public without some sort of permission. So we called Vincent Candelora from ASCAP, that's the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, and asked him to shed some light.
Playing an iPod in a public space is really no different than someone playing a CD or a tape, or any other recorded copyrighted music. Under the federal copyright law, it requires permission from the copyright owner in order to publicly perform that song.
Doesn't matter, Mr. Candelora said, whether they are here or abroad, big or small, they gotta pay the piper.
The very small percentage of establishments that try and get away with it, if you will. And ultimately, we catch up with them.
Whether you've got a license for music, a license to drive, or no license at all, we'd still like to hear from you. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. In this country, it's not all that tough to imagine a life without siblings. There are families with just one child all over the place. Now, though, extend that to a life with no cousins, no aunts, no uncles, just one child, mom, dad, and maybe grandma and grandpa. For tens of millions of kids in China today, that's the reality, almost 30 years after the government banned Chinese parents from having more than one child. This week on the broadcast, we're taking some time to explore the economic effects of that policy, which has now produced a whole generation of only children. Marketplace's Scott Tong picks up his series in Nanjing in eastern China.
For sixth grader Fang Jingxue, the day starts at 7 sharp with a
Baba, 快点来.
Hurry up from her mom. The 12-year-old grunts a word of compliance and then pulls on her clothes. Mm-hmm. Green hoodie sweatshirt, black cotton pants, and pink eyeglasses. The morning hustle feels like my house on a school day. But this is a Saturday. Fang Jingxue explains why. Tutoring class every weekend.
First two classes of English, then one science, one writing, one Chinese, then two math classes. It goes late, so we eat dinner at the school.
Mom Fang Rong nukes some sesame porridge. They wolf it down and scamper down 7 flights of stairs. No elevator here. It's hectic, Mom says. Every family is racing to get its one child ahead.
Competition is fierce, so we all feel we have to do something, right or wrong. If parents don't put kids in tutoring classes, they panic.
Fang Rong, the mom, is a factory quality control worker, making $7,000 a year, about the median income in urban China. Dad works at a factory, too. Together, they spend 10% of their income on their daughter's schooling. Surveys suggest other families shell out as much as 50%. It makes for a thriving education market, says Tom Doktoroff at the marketing firm J. Walter Thompson.
Anything that helps a kid become smarter and able to compete in an increasingly dog-eat-dog landscape is a priority for the parents. Whether it's English lessons or piano lessons, parents are going to spend money and time in making sure their kids are equipped to rise.
As they board the city bus, Feng Jingxue's mom carries her Hello Kitty backpack for her. Mom says the books are too heavy. It seems an overdose of caution, but my Chinese friend John Liu explains.
Our hope for future depend on one hope. Good or bad, he or she is the only hope.
Fang Jingxue and her mom now get off the bus and walk 5 blocks to a Nanjing middle school that she's applying to. She'll take an assessment test today with dozens of other 6th graders. As she walks in the gate, her mom says, slow down, baby. She says every parent here looks stressed, the kids too. Fang Rong says it wasn't always this way. When she grew up in the 70s, children in her neighborhood just played outside the weapons factory where their parents worked. Until 5 o'clock came.
When the factory horn went off, we grabbed our book bags and sprinted home. We took out our homework and pretended to work, just as my mom got home.
Back then, almost everyone in China was equally poor. Now, there's social mobility, more competition, and many say more stress. Fang Jingxue emerges from the test 90 minutes later. She says teachers had her read articles out loud and converse in English. Results won't be out for a while. They zoom home for lunch, and later it's off to cram school for 6 hours, beginning with English.
What is the weather like? It's raining.
Now, right around now in my house in Shanghai, my kids are focusing their brains on the monkey bars, risking life and limb. Education value, zero. My friend 30-something mom, Shirley Wang, doesn't get it.
We don't think fun is that important. Skill, your capability to survive in society is more useful, more meaningful than just to have fun.
Okay. Back at the Fang household in Nanjing, it's now Sunday morning. Sixth grader Fang Jingxue knocks off some math homework with mom, and then one brief indulgence. They walk to a stationery store and buy a special pen that writes in multicolors. China's consumer market for one-kid families is huge.
fast food, toys, and especially infant formula. Chinese TV is full of ads for it. This one promises, buy this. It helps brain development. Again, ad man Tom Doctoroff.
Even if you're talking about a Happy Meal, all right, that Happy Meal isn't just for happiness. It has to have an education lesson in there, or it has to have something that helps move the child forward.
Fang Jingxue's last weekend class is ballet. Mom Fang Rong pays $9 a class because she says her daughter's used to it. Not that she's passionate about dancing, or for that matter, anything.
Nothing makes her very happy or very upset. In our time, I used to dream about eating a meatball every day. Kids today have no passion. They have everything.
Fang Rong admits she's conflicted about investing all this time and money putting her daughter on the education treadmill. But everyone's doing it. At least, she says, Fang Jingxue can hang out with other children at weekend school. That's where all the children are. In Nanjing, Eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today about the oil leak in the Gulf. This afternoon, a federal judge overruled the White House. He said the president's six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling just isn't going to work. The White House is already working on its appeal on that one. We called a couple of companies in oil-related businesses down on the Gulf Coast to get their take. They all said they're just going to wait and see how this whole thing shakes out before they actually start doing anything, just adding to the confusion, I imagine. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 148 points, almost 1.5%. The Nasdaq slipped down 27 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 lost 17 points, more than 1.5%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that is where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, smaller families in China by choice.
Just because people live in rural China or lower tier cities doesn't mean that they have any less exposure to a lot of the different things that young people all over China are wanting.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.